To many people, the COP process is like a black box. But today we try and open that box and take you behind the scenes what actually goes on in the negotiations and what was the result of COP26 in Glasgow.
In a way, a COP is at least three different conferences at one.
First, I have a conversation with Denmark's climate ambassador, Thomas Anker Christensen. And later, I call Laurence Tubiana in Paris. She was one of the main architects behind the Paris Agreement. And ask her how she evaluates the outcome of COP26 in Glasgow.
I think the COP26 has been a very much needed moment.
Welcome to Planet A, a podcast on climate change. My name is Dan Jørgensen. I am Minister of Climate, Energy and Utilities in Denmark. In a series of conversations, I ask some of the world's leading experts, policymakers and activists how to stem climate change.
We, the human species, are confronting a planetary emergency.
For more than 30 years, the science has been crystal clear.
The reason I believe we need to act now is because the facts are staring us in the face.
The time to answer humankind's greatest challenge is now.
L'accord de Paris pour le climat est accepté.
So this gives us the best possible shot to save the one planet we've got.
There is no plan B because we do not have planet B.
You're listening to Planet A, a podcast on climate change and what to do about it. Normally, I invite policymakers, experts or activists to join me in a conversation about climate change and what to do about it. But today, I've chosen to invite Denmark's climate ambassador, Thomas Anker Christensen. Welcome, Thomas.
Thank you, Dan.
You sat next to me during the negotiations that we have just finalized in Glasgow at the COP26. I was given the task, together with my colleague Simon Steele from Canada, to facilitate talks on one of the tracks in the negotiations, and that was the mitigation track. So the talks that had to do with how do we keep 1.5 alive. And today's conversation between you and I hope will give people a view into how negotiations like that unfold. So we're going behind the scenes, but maybe also, if we're lucky, it can serve as a sort of a primer to COP negotiations. I think for many people, it's probably a black box. What's actually going on in those buildings with tens of thousands of people in them for a couple of weeks in Glasgow. So are you ready for that?
Exactly. How do you actually get to an outcome?
Let's try and do it. First of all, what is the COP?
The COP is the meeting of all the countries, governments who have signed on to the Climate Convention and have agreed to come together once a year to look at how far they are in implementing the convention. And after the Paris Agreement, there has been added a layer of meetings focused especially on how we are doing in implementing and in realizing the promises and pledges we've made in Paris. And that is especially on how good we are at keeping faithful to the temperature target of Paris, but also the target on financing, on adaptation, on helping the most vulnerable countries, and so on and so forth.
Yeah. So COP is short for Conference of Parties, and a party is a country most often. So the process actually never stops. So there's a meeting once a year. Last year we didn't have one because of COVID, but there's a meeting once a year and there's been 26 of them. That's why it's called COP26. Already now, negotiators have started talking about the next meeting in 27. So negotiators, especially on a very technical level, the ones that are dealing with the more bureaucratic side of things, so the actual rules that we need to fulfill as members of this collaboration, they negotiate more or less all the time.
That's right. And when they don't negotiate, they prepare the negotiations. In the UN, you spend half your time agreeing on the process.
Yes.
The process is politics in the UN.
And some people might think, how can it take more than 26 years to agree on something that's obvious? We need to do something about climate change. And I think one way to look at it is that try and think of how difficult it is for just you as a normal person to arrange a dinner party with 10 of your friends or 20 of your friends. Try to then negotiate what's going to be the menu, who's going to pay, when are you going to have the first course, all of that. And then imagine agreeing 197 countries from different parts of the world with different political systems about something that's extremely important to the everyday life of every citizen of all of these countries. When you think about it like that, it's actually an extraordinary process that has led to historic progress, even though some of us sometimes thinks it's a slow process and it should move faster.
Absolutely. And I mean, one example of the slowness that is surprising to many people is that this year, the text that you were facilitating, it's probably the first time in 26 years that the science around climate change has not been questioned. And everybody could agree to the fact that it is really urgent to do something about it. Well, unfortunately, it's taken us 26 COPs to get to that realization. But that was also one of the big breakthroughs that we could actually focus, and you in your role could focus on the how to solve the climate challenge and not on the what. The what everybody agreed to.
Yeah, and you need to remember, obviously, that all countries has a veto power. So that's why the analogy with trying to agree with your friends on where to go to eat dinner is a good one, because this is not like a normal parliament or many democratic institutions where you can vote. I mean, if all countries don't agree, there will not be an agreement. Now, this means, of course, also that sometimes you have also very irrational interests being, probably not irrational for the countries that are arguing them, but irrational for the planet as a whole, interests that are being put at the forefront of the negotiations. But as you said, Thomas, this year was different because we didn't really spend a lot of time discussing whether or not this is even a problem. And we didn't spend a lot of time discussing whether or not the science shows us that we need to act now, fast. And that is huge progress. Think about the last time we met 2 years ago in Madrid. There, the US, for instance, United States of America, they had decided to pull out of the Paris Agreement. Among other reasons for that was that there was a president, President Trump, who said, well, he didn't really believe in the science on this issue. So we've come a far, far way in that sense. Now, let's try and dive into what then actually happens at a COP, because negotiations take place, and we'll dive into that later. But I said tens of thousands of people meet early on, and some people listening to this might be wondering, who are all these people?
In a way, a COP is at least three different conferences at one. One is the negotiations about both the technical details and the more political ones that we'll get to. But the second is also a big meeting of people engaged in climate action who talk about what actions you can take to accelerate, whether it's build out of forests or mangroves or electric vehicles or whatever technical or other solutions. And it's like a huge fair with all kinds of solutions being talked about. And there's a day devoted to each of the major themes, energy, forests, oceans, youth, cities, and so on. And then there's a third almost conference in the conference, which is more for the activists and the indigenous peoples and the youth and women and others, that takes place in a separate part of the conference area. And there are these sort of three circles of activists, more business and solutions, and then negotiations that happen at the same time. And in a way, also are physically constructed in such a way that they put pressure on each other, but especially at the end on the negotiators, for them to come to a good outcome.
Yes, and if we look at what happened in Glasgow, one of the new things, which in a way is new because there's been attempts to do this before, but one of the things that succeeded for the first time, I think, was that the British presidency had managed to put together negotiation tracks that weren't formal UN negotiation tracks, but that led to agreements on, for instance, the scale down of methane emissions, on forestry, on cars. All of these things that when you add them up actually leads to quite big emission reductions. I think that the IEA, the International Energy Agency, they calculated that if you look at what's the official pledges from countries and you add all of these new agreements, even though they're not legally binding, if countries actually do what they've pledged to do, then we would be at a temperature increase of 1.8 degrees. Now, if you just add up the NDCs, which is what the countries have pledged without these negotiations and without these agreements, then we're at 2.7. So it does really matter.
It is extremely important, and you're absolutely right. We've had these action days and these coming together of all different types of people with the focus on solutions for many years. This was the first time that the attempt was made to have each day come to tangible proposals, solutions, declarations that, if they are acted upon, also deliver results. And one challenge to many governments will now be to integrate what they signed up to do in their national climate plan, in their NDC. For example, the methane that you mentioned. 105 countries signed this methane declaration to reduce their methane emissions by 30% in 2030. That is not reflected in any of the climate plans that the governments have submitted to the UN.
And that, of course, leads us then to the more official negotiations and the track that I was facilitating together with my colleague Simon Steele, because one of the things we discussed there was exactly the question about the NDCs. So when countries pledge how much to reduce and how to do it, it obviously really matters, because that's the cornerstone of all efforts and everything we're doing. But if you look at how many countries have actually submitted the NDCs, it's not all yet. And which is an even bigger problem, the ones that have, they're not ambitious enough. They're not aligned with the Paris Agreement target of staying below 1.5. Now, maybe we should just start by saying a few words about that target and then come back to what are we then actually going to do about those NDCs. But we talk about 1.5, but actually, if people remember negotiations a decade before now, for instance, the very famous meeting in Copenhagen in 2009, COP15, there the talk wasn't about how to stay below 1.5, it was how to stay below 2 degrees. So things have changed there. Can you maybe just say a few words about what exactly is it that's changed and how and why?
Yeah, in Copenhagen, 2 degrees was the focus. And when we came to Paris in 2015, 2 degrees was still the benchmark that was also proposed to be included in the Paris Agreement. But in the last days of negotiations in Paris, a coalition was mobilized, led by the Marshall Islands, the so-called High Ambition Coalition, that very strongly argued that for the most vulnerable countries, the low-lying island states, the least developed countries that are very vulnerable, 1.5 is really the threshold above which they will be really in dire straits and will be suffering and maybe even will disappear from the face of the earth. So in the final push for the Paris Agreement, the language was changed to 2 degrees, but preferably working towards 1.5. And since then, we got an IPCC climate science report a few years ago that basically said that anything beyond 1.5, we don't know where the planet is heading and what that will mean to the physical environment we live in. So at this COP, it was agreed that actually it's now 1.5 that is the focus, and there's a language in the text that resolves to focus on 1.5.
Yes, and it's important to note that not only is 1.5 very important to the most vulnerable countries, it's also important because at the other side of 1.5, that's probably where the self-enhancing effect sets in. That's where we'll, experience tipping points. So it was huge progress that now we don't really discuss any longer whether or not we should aim for 1.5. The official text is still that it's below 2, but well below 2 and aiming at 1.5. But if you look at the focus on the 1.5 in the text, it's very clear that things have definitely moved. Now, how do we then do that? Well, actually, the whole purpose of the new NDCs that were to be pledged this year was to reach a situation where when you added them up, it would be feasible for us to stay below 1.5. Now, that just didn't happen. I mean, a lot of countries did in fact pledge more ambitious targets. My own country, our own country, Thomas, we've said that we will reduce by 70% in 2030 compared to 1990. Now, that's probably also, if not the most ambitious target in the world, and definitely one of them. But also look at the EU as a whole. I mean, we've decided to reduce by 55%, which is a huge progress. Look at the US, they've said between 50 and 54, is it? But that's compared to 2005. If you compare to 1990, as you should in this process, it's probably around 43%. So there has been a lot of progress. China said that they will peak in 2030.
At the latest.
So a lot of progress, and I'm not at all neglecting that. It is extremely important. It's been difficult for countries and groups of countries, but doesn't change the fact that at the bottom line, we are far from where we need to be. If you add all this up, we are probably looking at a temperature increase of at least 2.7 degrees. And since we know that after 2 degrees, self-enhancing effects will set in, that number is probably much, much higher. So we need to do more. So can you maybe just, you know, how do we explain it to the listeners what kind of a situation it was that we were met with when we entered the negotiations in Glasgow? What did we have to achieve?
The science, the 1.5 degree report basically tells us that we need to reduce emissions by 45% in 2030 in order to stay on track.
Compared to now.
And the synthesis report produced by the UN Secretariat compiling the NDCs that you mentioned tell us that we will not decrease by 2030 with the existing climate plans, the existing NDCs, but increase with 13-14%.
So we're pretty far from
being pretty far from where we need to be in a 2030 perspective. And the 2.7 that you mentioned is if you draw the line all the way to 2050 or for China 2060, and you assume that the countries will do what it takes to get to the 2050-2060 benchmark, then eventually emissions will start going down.
Because countries have pledged to be carbon neutral or
by the mid-century.
But
in the short term to 2030, we're actually going up. So the challenge you were facing was basically to put in place a mechanism that can bring emissions down instead of them going up until 2030. The gap between now and 2030. It's the real challenge.
Yeah, so what goes on in a meeting like that is that there are different tracks. So this track was facilitated by Simon Steele and myself. There was then another track on financing, which we'll talk about later, that was facilitated by
Sweden and Egypt.
Yes, and then there was the Article 6, which is the carbon market and all the rules connected to that, which was in Norway and Singapore, mm-hmm. I believe, and there were several others. So that's just to say that a lot of ministers are active in a lot of different rooms trying to, I wouldn't say close deals, but at least find common ground on different tracks, but knowing very well that it's all interconnected. So you cannot really talk about mitigation without talking about financing, and you cannot really talk about financing without talking about mitigation. Nonetheless, that is the way the negotiations are structured. And I do actually think it makes sense because it forces parties to look at what's actually in front of them on the table. What's the wording? Can we live with this if we get what we want in the other negotiations in the other rooms? That's what we try to do. And, you know, just to be very, you know, direct in what goes on is that it's meetings from very early in the morning to very late in the evening in small cold rooms with no windows and bad coffee. And basically, countries negotiate in different groups, and they then put forward their arguments and where they see the text going, because usually we will be negotiating on the basis of a text written up by the presidency. The presidency, of course, does this on the basis of whatever feedback they get from facilitators like myself and Simon. But can you maybe, Thomas, just to explain to people how this works, say a few words about how countries then negotiate in groups?
Well, absolutely, but let me just start somewhere else, though, because in total, the British presidency had asked seven teams of ministers.
Yeah.
And that means there were seven major issues that needed to be solved.
Yeah.
And the only ones who had the full overview over those seven issues were the British, with the UN Secretariat supporting them. And the package that they tried to cook, what became the Glasgow Climate Pact, is a careful balance between those seven issues where some countries or groupings of countries have special interest in one or more of those seven, but maybe not all have the same equal interest in all seven.
Of course.
And the final package, the final balance, the success of the conference, in a way, lies on them understanding well enough the priorities of all the important groups on all seven items.
And maybe I should also just add that the track that I was responsible for with Simon, the Keeping 1.5 Alive track that has to do with mitigation, that wasn't actually formally on the agenda. So it wasn't really even certain that we were going to be negotiating this before the COP started. So we'd prepared it for months, but we had to wait for the agenda to be formally accepted on the Monday of week two before we could actually start the formal negotiations. Because if parties had objected in the plenary, then okay, too bad, we cannot negotiate this now.
And it might sound absurd to the listeners, but the fact that 1.5 degrees and how to reduce emissions was not formally on the agenda, but that's because in Paris it was decided that that's a national jurisdiction. It's something countries do and put forward their climate plans under a national competence. And it's only now with the Glasgow Pact, with the text that you were in charge of, that there will be an agenda item and a work program and a formal process under the Paris Agreement every year to look at this.
And that's exactly what came out of the negotiations, which was, in my view, a big success. And I totally agree with Alok Sharma, the president from the British government, president of the COP, when he said that we wanted to keep 1.5 alive at this COP, and we have done so. Why? Yes, because if we hadn't made the decisions where we say to countries that they need to update their NDCs already next year, it wouldn't have happened until, well, there would be a stocktake in 23 and new NDCs in 25. And those NDCs, by the way, would primarily deal with what happens after 30. So this was really our last chance of making formal rules that secures that this discussion is not dead. So put differently, we could have really closed the door. We could have really killed the target if we hadn't made this decision. Now, the fact that we've made it is not the same as that. Not the same as saying that okay, everything is all good. We will definitely stay below 1.5. Not at all. It's just saying that now at least we have the possibility, because now there will be this formal mechanism. Almost we don't call it a mechanism, but de facto it is a mechanism where there's a work program, there's an annual synthesis report that you can base the discussions on, there's an annual ministerial where ministers will discuss mitigation, and already next year we'll have this revision of the NDCs, and they need to be in line with the Paris Agreement. There's one more important thing that we need to talk about that was in this track also, which is the mentioning of coal and subsidies to fossils. But you still haven't answered the question about the different groups.
No, so let's dive into that for a second. Starting with the Europeans, they negotiate as the European Union, so it's not individual European countries, Germany, France, Denmark. We don't negotiate on our own. We are represented by the European Commission or member states of the EU who have a mandate from the group and go and talk on their behalf. And in your role, it was actually Germany who represented the EU,
yeah,
together with the with.
So in a way, I was negotiating with myself.
Yes.
Because I was at one side of the table asking the European Union what their position was, which I was also a part of setting. But that's the way it is.
Developing countries are working through the G77 and China group, but they are also working through smaller groups that represent their special interests. So they came to you as G77 and China. In that meeting, there was also representatives of small islands and of least developed countries, but also China was there on their own behalf in one meeting. But then you had the African group, where it was Kenya speaking on behalf of the Africans. You had the Arab group, where it was Saudi Arabia speaking on behalf of the Arabs. You had a group of the so-called umbrella group, which was both U.S. and Canada and others, but also Russia.
You had the basic group.
You had the basic group with Brazil, China, India, and South Africa, and so on and so forth.
And then you have big countries like China coming also
on their own.
On their own.
The U.S. on their own.
Now, I do understand if listeners are thinking, "Wait a minute! I thought this was going to help me understand things because." The fact of the matter is that sometimes countries are actually negotiating in different groups. Now, sometimes it's even the case that they will be arguing different things in different groups, yes, because they will, of course, then be a part of a compromise in that group. And that makes it, to say the least, a little bit complicated and also a little bit difficult to try and find common grounds. But the way it works is that when you, day after day after day in these negotiations, listen to the arguments, try and find what could be a common ground. Also, of course, looking at what do we need in order for us to deliver on what is necessary, which in this case was keeping 1.5 alive. Then you get closer to something that could end up being a compromise. Having said that, as you mentioned earlier, it's only the presidency that has the whole overview of what's going on. And also you need to rely on gut feeling sometimes. Will this stand in the end? So when the final text was put forward in the plenary Saturday, so that's 24 hours after the official ending of the COP, that's another thing. The COP is supposed to end always Friday midday, but it never does. It always goes on another day or so. When the final text came, we didn't know whether or not there was a compromise, whether or not it would stand or whether or not we should negotiate for another 24 hours or maybe not, or maybe we couldn't even get an agreement. But it did, and it did, of course, also because there was a balance with regards to some of the other things that we'll talk about in a minute. But before we get to that, one very contested sentence in the mitigation text had to do with the phase out of coal and the stop of subsidizing fossils. Now, I think most people that follow this issue would probably say to themselves, what? I mean, it must be obvious that we need to phase out coal, otherwise we won't have a chance of reaching the targets that we need. But it is extremely contested, and it's never been mentioned in a COP text before. Can you say, Thomas, just a few words about what is it that makes something that should be obvious not so obvious?
Well, for one, many countries believe that they cannot have economic and industrial development without having coal as the base of their energy system. And industrial development in Europe, in the West, in the OECD, has been based on coal. And there's no country that has gone through modern industrialization without having coal as their base. Mm. And the large developing countries, China, India, Indonesia, South Africa, etc., they all look at that model and believe that in order for them to become rich and their population to become middle class, that pathway goes through a coal-based energy system.
And they argue that it's not really fair for Western countries to say, okay, so we have burned coal for more than 100 years and we've become rich by doing it and created the problem that we're all facing, but now it's up to you guys to solve the problem by not doing the same mistakes as we did. That's basically the argument, and I think actually, by the way, that it's a pretty fair argument. That's also why we are trying to work with the principle called common but differentiated responsibility. Mm. That means it's also in the Paris Agreement. It means that the responsibility is one that we share all countries on the planet. So even developing countries can't say, well, because we are at a lower stage of development, we shouldn't do anything. No, everybody needs to do something. On the other hand, it's a differentiated responsibility, because obviously the Western countries, the richer countries, we are the ones creating the problem in the first place, and we also have a moral obligation because we are at another place in our development. So this has been very contested. It still is. But nonetheless, I think most countries would agree to that principle now. What makes it even more complicated then is that, okay, so I think you'll see that countries like China and India and others say, well, we also know that we need to move away from coal, but you need to understand, they will tell us and the rest of the world, that we can't do it as fast as maybe you want, and also our population needs it. And with regards to subsidies on fossil fuels, well, sometimes that's also something that we use to eradicate poverty. And that's why this is not about some people that wants to fight climate change and others that don't. It's about coming from different places and having different interests, and obviously also having different conditions vis-a-vis the development of your country and the poverty that you might struggle to eradicate.
That's why the UN Secretary General has been arguing for the last couple of years that developed countries, OECD countries, should end coal in their energy system by 2030, and developing countries could continue with coal until 2040. That's in that spirit of differentiated responsibilities. And there's an alliance called the Powering Past Coal Alliance that has that principle sort of in its DNA. And it's that alliance that has been very much driving the effort to phase out coal and to end the build of coal power stations. And I would say in Glasgow, we did actually come a far way, because now it's clear that all countries will stop funding coal in other countries. And many countries will stop funding fossils as part of their export credits and trade. And this paragraph that was so contested, there is actually a commitment to start the phase down of coal. But that paragraph is also about the transition to clean power energy systems. It's about the transition that every country has to go through at speed in order to stay on the 1.5 degree pathway.
Exactly. Because if we go back to the plenary, it's Saturday midday now, the presidency has put forward a text, and they've acknowledged that, okay, the original text, which said we need to phase out coal and we need to stop subsidizing fossil fuels, had been changed. So that now it said phase out inefficient fossil fuels, but it still said phase out coal. That was contested by especially India, but also a few other countries. And that then started a strange negotiation, really, but quite normal for the COP process, where people were huddling up on the actual floor trying to find a solution to this. And in the end, the presidency then proposed to say, okay, we'll change the wording so it says phase down coal. And that then was accepted by all countries. It's also worth mentioning that after India and others had said, okay, well, this is not the right balance for us, a very large group of developing countries, small island states, the most vulnerable, really, countries that we have on the planet, they took the floor and they said, well, this is not a perfect compromise. We would have liked it to be more ambitious on many levels, but we would urge all countries to support this compromise, because it's so important for us to keep the 1.5 alive. And there are some progress also on financing here that we need.
Absolutely. And I think that's where this notion of the package comes in, that there were other elements in the Glasgow Climate Pact that these countries also very much appreciated. There was a pledge, a commitment to achieving the 100 billion in climate finance. There was a promise to double financing for adaptation. There was the start of a process to define a global adaptation goal. A new financing target for what comes after 2025.
And maybe let's just dive into that, because I'm not sure everybody knows exactly what you're talking about there, Thomas. So the 100 billion goal, it's something that if you're engaged in these negotiations, it's just something everybody knows what you're talking about when you mention the 100 billion. But maybe we should just explain that that's what was promised. I think you mentioned it earlier also in Copenhagen back in 2009, the COP15.
Yep. It was written into the Paris Agreement.
Formalized in the Paris Agreement, mm-hmm. $100 billion a year from 2020 to 2025. And so far, countries haven't delivered on that yet. It's not just grants or aid directly from government to government or via institutions. It's also private financing. So basically, it's mobilizing $100 billion a year. And frankly speaking, I think it's embarrassing that we haven't done that yet. Our own country, Denmark, does quite a lot, and we will be responsible for mobilizing 1% of mm-hmm. that $1 billion. So I think that it's fair to say that we are definitely doing our part, but it just hasn't happened yet. What became the result of the negotiations and the important work done before the COP was that it seems like we will now reach this in 2023, maybe even next year in 2022.
That's right. And maybe on average over the 5 years, we will still be delivering the $100 billion per year, because the trajectory is that we will overshoot by quite a lot as we move towards 2025. And I think the back end was extended until 2027 in order to give the assurance to developing countries that they will get the funding that is.
And then, of course, there's the adaptation part. That's important, because when you mobilize financing, especially if it's private finance on the market, it's easier to get investors to put their money in building an offshore wind farm than it is to put their money in climate adaptation, because climate adaptation is very often, well, basically not a good business case. It's more about helping. It can be sometimes a good business case. There are solutions that will provide benefits both economically and with regards to adaptation, but most often it's not. So we need especially public grants to be much higher in this. In Denmark, we've said that we will use 60% of our public grants in climate finance to adaptation, and fortunately other countries have followed that, but not enough. And therefore it was so important that it was on the agenda in Glasgow, and I think the result, which is to double the amount given to climate adaptation, is very, very important. And I think also, if you would ask many of the vulnerable countries, they would say that was probably the most important outcome of the COP.
I fully agree, and I think when you listen to what those countries said in the final debate that you referred to on the 1.5, they were also stressing that the package that was on the table was very good for them, and they supported the package in that sense. And the final element that we need to mention here is on loss and damage. That is the request from all those countries that get hit the hardest by extreme weather events. They are asking for a mechanism that can compensate them for the damages done, because many of them have to go to the private capital markets and take on very expensive loans, and they pay very, very high rents for interest rates for this, and they feel that they are suffering doubly. They both get hurt and have to pay a lot of money for the damage that is done. We didn't reach a solution on this, but we had the decision to have a fast track conversation on how to finance it, and that probably will lead to the setting up of some kind of financing mechanism on this. There was a proposal that came very, very late on the table at the conference, and we simply didn't have time enough to study it and look at it. I think amongst donors, there is a small reticence for creating new mechanisms. We created the Green Climate Fund a few years ago, and it took us 5 years of negotiations to actually operationalize it. And we want something that works faster than 5 years.
See, this is a dilemma, right? Because on one hand, we need this, and I totally understand the countries that have been arguing very hard to get it fast. On the other hand, in the UN and as a part of an official process, there needs to be rules, and it needs to be also negotiated, and that takes time. But I think we're on track now, and that's also a positive outcome. Another outcome was that what happens after 25, when there's no longer the pledge to pay $100 billion a year, so we'll need a new number there, probably much higher, at least that's what many argue. And if you look at the actual need, it's trillions, not billions. So something will happen, and there's a process now in line for how to deal with that. Now, the last thing I just want to mention, which was also a very important part of the negotiations, was the so-called Article 6. do you want to give it a try? It's difficult to explain.
Yeah, and especially because you were referring to the disruption of the final plenary that happened over coal. What the public hasn't really focused on is that we had a similar disruption that lasted 3 hours over Article 6 before we got to coal.
Yeah.
And that was caused by the rainforest nations who felt that their interest in forests and how to be compensated for negative emissions in their forest wasn't taken care of. And they raised a storm and it took 3 hours to sort it out.
Yeah.
Article 6 is really about the carbon credit regime in the Kyoto Protocol. There was an elaborate setup of how you could, as a industrialized country, buy carbon credits.
So you couldn't make the reductions that you wanted yourself. You could pay others to do them.
Especially in countries with a lot of forests, where the forest absorbs the CO2 and in a way has negative emissions.
Yeah.
So you could buy part of the forest in a forest-rich country and that could sort of compensate for the emissions that you have. And the what has been negotiated since 2015, since Paris, was both how much of those old credits you could carry over in the new system, but then also how you should account for it. And there's been a lot of focus on avoiding double counting, because in a way, if I buy a credit from you, you can't count that what I have bought as part of your emissions or negative emissions. So there has to be a transparent scheme where the accounting moves from your account to my account.
And how do you know also that it's even a real reduction? I mean, for instance, if a country says, well, we were planning on chopping down these trees,
exactly,
but if you pay us money, we won't do it. How do you know that that's actually what would have happened? So the arguments for having a system like this is, of course, that you will get an inflow of money from richer countries to poor countries that need them. You'll get a very cost-efficient way of reducing. The arguments against it is that, well, first of all, rich countries might then just pay others to do what they should do themselves in their own countries. And it's very difficult to do this in a way where we don't risk that it's actually just hot air being sold.
Yeah. And the same thing for the transfer of credits, that we tried to limit how old credits you could carry over, because the further back in history you could go, the more you could actually absolve some countries from doing anything, and it could undermine the whole credibility of the national climate plans that we are trying to put in place. So the cutoff year was set to 2013, and only for credits that can count as part of the first round of national climate plans that run until 2020. So hopefully that can sort of box it in. Then there was one more part of that negotiation, which was about the so-called share of proceeds. That is, if any of the money that is being paid for these credits should be going to financing adaptation obligatorily. That was not, no compromise on that was found. It ended up being voluntary. And I think especially the United States had, John Kerry over the microphone had to give a public assurance to the African group that the US would also be making payments to this going forward.
Yeah,
because that was the understanding, that it wouldn't be obligatory, but that countries would in good faith do it.
Yeah. Yes, well, all in all, first of all, I think we would be remiss if we didn't mention how well the presidency did. This was a very, very difficult task, not least because of the COVID crisis. So yes, they had another year to plan it, but it was also under circumstances that made it very, very difficult. Mm-hmm. But I do think that they did an excellent job finding difficult compromises and on difficult issues. Thomas, you've been very close also to the presidency and their team. Team, you think about a few people, but it's actually a lot of people. Can you say maybe just a few words about the machinery of this? How big of a deal is it to be COP president?
Well, for the way the UK has approached it, they had in the cabinet office, that is directly under the prime minister, a team of between 125 and 150 people working with the COP presidency. They also had a climate envoy, my counterpart, John Merton. But then in addition, also in the Foreign Office, a climate ambassador and five regional climate ambassadors, each in charge of their own region, plus a reinforcement of all their embassies with extra staff and other ministries in line in charge of energy or transport or forests. So I think the total number of people involved on the British side must be, on the substance, more than 500.
Yeah.
And then on top, security, logistics,
it's a
COVID, health personnel, thousands and thousands of people. I think they have said something like at least £500 million in cost.
It's really a daunting task, but I think they did very, very well. And I think that the result, even though obviously, speaking as a Danish climate minister, I would have hoped that we could have gone even further on some of the issues, especially on financing. But nonetheless, it was much better than I would than I had feared, especially taking into consideration how difficult it is for countries right now. So you are actually asking countries to do things in their societies that will, well, take a lot of effort and that will also need a lot of funding allocated in a situation where many countries are busy just surviving, basically. So what happens now is that the COP presidency is still the UK and will be until November next year. Mm. So it's actually only formally a new president when the meeting starts in November in Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt. But can you just take us through just briefly what is then the tasks of the incoming presidency, which is Egypt, from now on until then?
For Egypt, they will have to start looking at the agenda. What are the major issues? How would they prepare for them? They need to think about whether they want to appoint ministers to be in charge of certain issues, but they also need to work with the UN Secretariat to prepare the more technical files. There's a preparatory meeting of negotiators held every year in Bonn in June. Hopefully next year we can have a physical meeting. Last year it was a virtual meeting. And they will need to prepare a lot of reports and inputs to the negotiations. So they really have to examine all the main issues and see how to approach them in order to help have a positive outcome in Sharm. You mentioned, Minister, there's a new negotiation on adaptation, there's a new one on finance, there's the work program for the 1.5, many issues already piling up that need to be dealt with. And I think the global public was in a way impatient before Glasgow, saying you need to do 1.5, otherwise it's blah, 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 as Greta Thunberg said. Well, now we've said we've put in place a mechanism that can bring us there. So next year they will be even more impatient in actually looking at us and saying, did you get it? Did you make it?
Okay, well, somebody who definitely knows a lot about the COP process, one of the main architects behind the Paris Agreement, former French climate change ambassador Laurence Tubiana, has been so kind as to also participate in this podcast. So thank you, Thomas, and stay tuned and listen to how Laurence Tubiana evaluates the result in Glasgow.
Thank you.
So being an experienced participant in COP meetings and even one of the main architects behind the Paris Agreement, how would you assess the COP26 and the Glasgow Climate Pact?
I think the COP26 has been a very much needed moment because of the need to complete Paris Agreement rules. And so from this point of view, Glasgow has been a very important step forward because we have finalized the different elements that we were negotiating in the last 5 years to complete these rule books, to just get the mechanism of what we call transparency, which is about how countries in a way check each other and how accountable they are to each other on their climate plans. I think it gave recognition, which was important, of the science in a much stronger than any time before. That with a 1.5 is the center of gravity of our objective, meaning the idea that we should not go above that threshold of global warming, and that we are not there, and the recognition that there was a gap in ambition for 2030, and that this gap has to be worked on immediately after Glasgow, because what we have in our hands now, the different plans that are being presented, are not fulfilling that gap. So this, from this point of view, I think it was a good result of Glasgow. Keeping on the government-to-government relations, I felt that it was a COP dominated in a way by the big emitters and the negotiation between them, of course, US and China in particular, and with a particular role for EU, but as well the idea that the G20 type of group was more active in this, because the pressure was on them and the negotiation went on how they can find a common ground there.
Yeah, probably also because they are the biggest emitters, so the pressure was on them.
Yeah, exactly.
One of the difficulties that that many journalists and others that try to explain what's actually going on in the process face, and therefore also one of the reasons why for people that are ordinary citizens that want to follow this process, is that it's quite technical. And you mentioned some of the elements that was actually concluded on. And I agree that that is a great progress. But I would probably also think that it would be a good idea if we help people understand what exactly it means. So the Paris rulebook, basically, some of the rules that was stated in the Paris Agreement hasn't been finalized yet, or hadn't been until Glasgow. So for 6 years, for instance, it had been discussed how to have transparency in the process, the carbon market, how should that function? Some countries, my own included, argued very forcefully that we needed to avoid double accounting on the climate credits in the market. Those things were concluded on. And can you maybe just say a few words about why it is that that's so important, but also how come it has been necessary for it to take 6 years?
I think there are two factors there. First, why it took so much time. One very important was the withdrawal of Paris Agreement from on the US side, and the fact that the big emitter, the second one bigger, very keen, by the way, normally on some of these issues about, again, transparency, what really countries are doing and how we can check. And though that has really given the climate diplomacy a big push for just stopping things. And so that is one explanation in my view. And so the combination of the two factors, the love for arguing and in a way negotiating of negotiators without the political pressure, because it took off because of US withdrawal, this explained largely plus the COVID, of course, last 2 years. It's technical details, awfully technical, but, you know, for example, how you can, when you are, anyway, Denmark, can check that Philippines or US are doing the jobs they promised to do. So this was really, so that's very important, because that we don't have sanctions in the Paris Agreement. So what is working, peer pressure, not only government to government, but civil societies that get access to information and can, in a way, blame government not to deliver enough because they have committed and they have signed up to this Paris Agreement. And this is, by the way, working. So that's why it was important to have the transparency. The carbon market is really important because, you know, you see that nowadays some countries or companies that are saying they are already carbon neutral, that finally they are doing the job well. And for the moment, most of the time, all of the time, it's because they are buying carbon credit elsewhere, whether in a country like Brazil on forest or on other places. And if you don't have good rules, so, you know, it could be totally fake, and it probably has been in many cases fake reduction in emissions. So it was very important to say, stop. We need really to now finally define the rules And as you said, then there is no double accounting possible. That when a country is selling its carbon credit to somebody else, it cannot count them on there. And that's why it's important. It's about the seriousness of the framework and the credibility. That's why we needed to complete these rules.
Obviously, one of the reasons why it has been difficult to negotiate, apart from the ones you mentioned, has been that there's a lot of financial interests in this. So a lot of countries have credits that they want to sell on the market from previously, where the discussion was whether or not that could be carried over into the new time frame, and a compromise made where there will be some carryover, and a country like my own would have rather seen, and I'm sure you would agree, that there was no carryover. But since it was necessary to make a compromise and solve all the problems you mentioned, I think bottom line, it's a compromise that was worth taking. And again, obviously, this also needs to be seen in the context of the whole agreement. Would you agree to that?
Yes, totally, Dan. And you're right to point out this very important issue about these credits that were generated within the Kyoto Protocol. And, you know, a lot of this carryover is detained by China, in particular. India and China, probably the most two countries that have them. Now it's done, the compromise is done, and we can hope that, I feel, for example, China is decided not to take any money out of this. So maybe this carryover will never be used. I hope so. And I hope so.
Well, there's been, in some of the news reporting about this, there's been some huge numbers on the potential damage of this, how it might be considered as hot air if it's credit sold as not real reductions. And well, as I said, and you confirmed, there is a danger there, but I don't think that those huge numbers that's been out there in the public debate are fair. I think the risk is much smaller. And as we both said, this was also necessary in order to close some of the loopholes. So on the headline that the presidency had for the negotiations was keeping 1.5 alive. That, of course, refers to the mitigation tracks. So when you say NDCs, that's, of course, nationally determined contributions. And that means that countries pledge how much they will reduce when and how. And the problem is that if we look at the NDCs that are in there now, they will take us to probably an increase in temperature of 2.7 degrees. Now, we need to go below 1.5, so that's a big problem. Now, if we had not made the decision we made in Glasgow, we wouldn't have had to revise the NDCs until in 2025. So that would probably then be too late for us if we were to still maintain the target of staying below 1.5, which of course we do. So it was extremely important to get a text that made it possible to put pressure on the countries that haven't yet submitted NDCs, or that haven't submitted NDCs that are in line with the Paris Agreement. And that actually ended up being the result. And I think that's probably the biggest success of the COP. Now, obviously, it's not enough to have the framework to do it, and it's not enough to have decided that. The countries then also need to deliver. So in your opinion, first of all, do you agree with me in that assessment? And in your opinion, what can we do now then to make actual action happen within the next meeting in Egypt next year?
Of course, I agree with you. This revision and coming back next year, not waiting even 2023, where we will make the global assessment where we are in terms of the Paris implementation, was a very important result. I totally agree with you. And in a way, of course, there was this tension between countries saying we don't want to reopen Paris Agreement, but on the other side, that was anticipated in Paris Agreement that we have to revise, and there was no necessary to wait for this every 5 years. So, and on the other side, a number of countries have not presented better NDCs, which was normally what they had to do in 2020, and many of them haven't presented anything new, or sometimes even we have seen countries presenting plans, we were backtracking from what they put forward in 2015. So that is, for this reason, is very important. Now, how we do that? That's where the complexity is. Now, how we will, in a way, discuss, it is a sovereign decision, as it is. So every country has to decide on its own. But now, of course, within a context where they should measure the climate risk for themselves and the actual threat that climate change is presenting, many times we see this cognitive dissonance, if I can say so, or this misinterpretation of what the climate action is, the global climate agreement is in each country's interest to limit the global warming, because everyone is very exposed. Even the richer countries, even the G20 countries, are very exposed to climate impact. So I think it's good in this year of 2020 to remind everybody that no country will escape the impacts, and that in the best interest to go ahead. The second element would be who finally is active in climate diplomacy this year. And it's a question mark. Can UK continue to do the job? Do we have the same energy? It's always difficult. Glasgow is really about a promise you have to implement the next year, because that's 2022 target and Sharm el-Sheikh. Can EU do a big part of the job, given a US that will be much more probably mobilized by internal issues next year and domestic issues and preparing for the midterm elections? I don't know. And it's a question mark. Who can take the lead, or who can really collaborate to do that? And I think it's interesting to mobilize everyone. And in particular, of course, I am very sensitive to what EU can deliver, because we have been in the leading seat on having a good climate plan as details. Of course, we can always hope for better, but it was the only one really, really precise and detailed. So Europe can do leading by example, but having a strong climate diplomacy, mobilizing all the resources in the government EU has, and there are very good people that know the topic and can talk to other countries. And I think a particular role, because I'm not sure that UK alone can do the job and can deliver the job next year.
That's a very important point. Now, unfortunately, we are running out of time, but I'd like to just have your final assessment also on another very important topic, which is the question about financing. As listeners will probably know, one of the problems has been that already back in 2015, that there should be mobilized $100 billion a year in climate finance to help mitigation and adaptation in some of the developing countries on the planet. Now, this hasn't happened yet. It's supposed to happen from 20 to 25. And could you maybe just outline how you see the result in the COP? Because what was then agreed was that, yes, it was addressed, and yes, we will get these money, but probably not until 2023.
I think the last miles of mobilization of money, in particular, by the way, on EU, but now the US has to deliver its part of this $100 billion a year. And I think it's first, in a way, get the US deliver will be very important. And we could do that in 2022, in a way, if we mobilize as well the resources that are in the multilateral development banks. We are not mobilizing enough. And I think we could have, in particular, the World Bank, and I would insist on that, because I think it's a collective effort to push World Bank in that direction, to mobilize much more money for climate, whether it is for mitigation or for adaptation. And that is very necessary if we can regain the trust and the confidence of developing countries who have been, in a way, in particular the less developed countries, felt uncomfortable at the end of the Glasgow Pact. They felt that they were not listened enough. And I think that's true. We have not been up to the solidarity, in a way, action we should have in this particular negotiation.
No, I definitely agree with you. And I do think one good thing that came out of the COP, though, was that it was decided to double the amount given to adaptation, climate adaptation. And that has been a problem, that of the climate funding that has been mobilized, too little a part of that has been guided towards adaptation. And it's not that mitigation is not important, and we need money for that as well, but it's just that the adaptation part is so important because many parts of the world are already experiencing the effects of climate change right now, and it's very difficult to mobilize private investments, for instance, to adaptation needs.
Absolutely, you're totally right.
No, well, thank you so much for that, and thank you so much for sharing your insights with us. I hope to see you soon again.
Absolutely, I hope there is a lot to do, isn't it? I know you will. Will contribute heavily, which is very, very reassuring, and very happy to continue informally the conversation when we have the time.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Bye.
Bye-bye, Dan. Thank you.
You've listened to Planet A, a podcast on climate change and what to do about it. If you want to know more about the climate policies of Denmark, you can follow my ministry, the Danish Ministry of Climate, Energy and Utilities, on social media platforms such as Twitter, Facebook and Instagram.